$50,000 goal, $53,000 is needed to maintain and preserve the collection. Your support will help pay for tapes to be transferred off reel-to-reel tape to digital format.
And the best way to keep away from arguments and differences, as I said earlier, put your religion at home, in the closet. Keep it between you and your God.
With your donations, we will be able to purchase much-needed digitization and duplication equipment, repair and maintain older equipment. So call with your pledge of support to the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Or visit our website at supportpra.org. That's supportpra.org. I'm Brian DeShazer for the Pacifica Radio Archives.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today's show on the draft government NIST report on the World Trade Center Twin Tower collapses was originally aired on September 28, 2005. This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun on.
The closer they get to the critical event, I mean, you remember, the thing that was most unexpected here was the total collapse of these buildings. We understood that the planes crashed into the buildings. We understood that there were fires in the buildings. What's so unexpected is that these buildings would totally collapse. And yet, the closer we get to that event, even getting as close as talking about some kind of initiation or something, it gets extremely vague. The closer we get, the vaguer it gets. And they completely truncate the timeline before the collapse even starts. So basically, the NIST report is like this Potemkin village that pretends to explain the collapses, but it doesn't even begin to.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Jim Hoffman. Today's show, Building a Better Mirage, NIST's cover-up of the crime of the century. Jim Hoffman is a software engineer, research scientist, and inventor. His work in applying scientific visualizations was instrumental in advancing minimal surface geometry in the 1980s and led to the discovery of new three-dimensional morphologies for modeling block copolymers. His graphics work has been widely published in journals like Science News, Scientific American, Science Digest, and Nature, and he co-authored papers in Science and Macromolecules. Jim Hoffman has been researching the World Trade Center collapses since February 2003 and has created an extensive website reporting his investigations and other aspects of the September 11th attacks at WTC7.com.
I'm more important.
It's good to be here.
Jim, you're well known for your popular website, 9/11 Research. For your research into the physical evidence of the World Trade Center Twin Towers and Building 7 collapses on September 11th. In the shows we did on Guns and Butter, Your Eyes Don't Lie, Common Sense Physics, and the World Trade Center Collapses, you deconstructed the FEMA report, that is the Federal Emergency Management Agency report, on how the Twin Towers collapsed. Now, I understand there are two official government reports on the physical evidence of the events of 9/11. And as I just mentioned, the first report, the FEMA report, you took that on in our first show. And now there is another official document out, the NIST report. You have written an article that deconstructs that report. But before we get to that, I thought we might just generally review briefly exactly what happened on September 11th, 2001 at the World Trade Center to the towers themselves. Planes hit and then the towers collapsed. What was the time sequence? What exactly transpired there?
Okay, so the first event that people became aware of was that at 8:46 a.m., a jetliner plowed into One World Trade Center, the North Tower, at about the 95th floor. And then only 18 minutes later, with cameras trained on the towers, a second jetliner crashed into the South Tower, further down the tower, on about the 80th floor. And there were fires in both towers. The fires in World Trade Center 1 were much more severe. In fact, the fires in World Trade Center 2, if you really look at the amount of smoke that was coming out of them, the amount of fire. You couldn't see any flames as the fires continued to burn. And 56 minutes after the crash in the second tower, the second one hit, totally collapsed. And then it was about another half hour before the north tower, the first one hit, and the one that had the serious fires in it, totally collapsed. So by 10:30 in the morning, both towers had collapsed. To call these collapses is kind of a euphemism because they, in fact, exploded. There's really no other way to describe it. Just look at any of the photographs of these events. These towers just mushroomed into these giant exploding dust clouds. The steel frames were shredded. Virtually all the non-metallic contents and constituents of these buildings was thoroughly pulverized, mostly into microscopic dust that blanketed lower Manhattan. I mean, these are just shocking events. And the events that I've spent the most time researching and pointing out the bankruptcy of the official story, because these are the core of the psychological trauma of the attack. As horrific as all the events were, as the plane crashes were, as even the attack on the Pentagon, these total collapses of these buildings were the key event that I think shocked people so profoundly that it's made it very difficult for people to even rationally evaluate what really happened.
Exactly how long did it take for these buildings to collapse, or, as you say, explode? Once they started to fall down, how long did it take?
Not very long at all, and these events happened suddenly. Recall that these fires were going on for some time. The fires in the South Tower seemed to be dwindling out, and then suddenly this building, the top of the South Tower, starts to lean a little bit, and then it just starts exploding into dust. I have done the most precise timing analysis using videos of the North Tower collapse, the second one, and it takes about 15 seconds for the process to go from start to completion. It's like a continuous explosion that just expands over a period of 15 seconds. These are very explosive events. In the case of the South Tower, there's a lot of eyewitness evidence coming out now. There was recently a release of the body of oral histories that had been collected in 2001 that had been bottled up because of the state was trying to keep these from getting out because they had a lot of frank recollections of what actually happened. These were just recently published as a result of the New York Times winning a court case, and there's all kinds of accounts of sounds of explosions right at the onset of the South Tower collapse, flashes, and of course the accounts very closely match what we see in the photographs indicating the explosiveness of these events, the production of dust, the rapid onset, the hurling of debris in all directions. I mean, these explosions, by the time they reached the ground, were about over 800 feet in diameter, two-thirds of the height of the building. That's how wide these explosions were by the time they reached the ground.
And you're saying that all of this took place in no longer than 15 seconds,
that's right. And it's interesting that for the longest time, both defenders and detractors of the official story would say that they took 9 or 10 seconds, which is completely wrong, because just watch the videos and you can see that they took 15 seconds. Now, 15 seconds is still a very rapid descent of these buildings, considering that if you were to take a brick and drop it in a vacuum from the roof of one of these towers, 1,360 feet, it would take 9.2 seconds to reach the ground. So this 15 seconds is only about 50-60% slower than the rate of unimpeded freefall in a vacuum.
You know, in our first series of shows on the physical evidence of the World Trade Center collapses, Your Eyes Don't Lie, you deconstructed the FEMA report, the Federal Emergency Management Agency report, and that was the first official report on how the Twin Towers collapsed. I thought we would begin by briefly going over what the original FEMA report said. What was its explanation for the physical collapses?
Well, they actually weren't very conclusive at all, because let's actually read what they said about the towers. A key passage in their explanation of the towers says, "With the information and time available, the sequence of events leading to the collapse of each tower could not be definitively determined." They were much vaguer yet about Building 7. Now, Building 7 is the 47-story steel skyscraper that stood across the street from the main World Trade Center complex. Building 7 was a World Trade Center building and address only. It was built 10 years after the rest of the complex. It was on a different block, different architectural style, and yet it had a World Trade Center address. Anyway, FEMA says about Building 7, the specifics of the fires in WTC-7 and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time. Further research, investigation, and analysis are needed to resolve this issue. What I wanted to point out was that when FEMA published their report in May of 2002, calling for further research, investigation, and analysis, coincidentally, the crime scene had been completely cleaned up and basically scrubbed, because shortly after the attack, FEMA immediately took over Ground Zero and immediately began to destroy the evidence by hiring demolition and construction companies to take the steel, take it to barges. They even built new infrastructure to expedite this removal and immediately started shipping the steel out to Asia and China, where it would be melted down, never to be seen again. Consider the significance of this. You have the three largest failures, according to the official explanation, of engineered steel structures in the history of the world, and yet the response to it is to do everything, apparently, to prevent a real investigation. FEMA assembled a team of volunteer investigators. The people that actually did the study and wrote the report were volunteers from the American Society of Civil Engineers who were given a budget of $600,000 by FEMA. They weren't even paid. That would barely even cover the cost of writing the report. $600,000 for this vast event. And then they come up with this inconclusive conclusion. And by the time they did that, there's, how convenient, there's no more steel with which to do further analysis.
So very briefly, what was FEMA's conclusion?
There's a number of explanations. If you go and try to enumerate all the various explanations that support the official story, it's interesting that right after the attack occurred, there were volunteer explanations. Structural engineers were talking about the fires having melted the steel, in spite of how ludicrous that is in terms of the physics of open fire temperatures versus what temperatures are required to melt steel. So FEMA's theory was one of several theories, but it was the most popular theory early on. Its theory, which I described as the trust failure theory, was also the one that was endorsed by the documentary that probably influenced most people's opinion of it, Why the Towers Fell. It was aired on PBS and the Discovery Channel. And the way that this theory goes is that the fires heated the trusses. There are these things called web trusses, which hold up the floors, and the floors span the distance between the core structures of these buildings and the perimeter walls, because there were two main vertical support elements of these buildings. They had a huge core structure that had 47 steel box columns, and then a perimeter wall that had about 240 smaller columns that ran the height of the building. And then it had these floor diaphragms that span the distance between the core structure and the perimeter wall. And so FEMA's theory blames these trusses, which are the steel structures that support the floors, becoming detached from the columns and then starting to fall down on each other, and then the floors pancaking down, leaving the columns freestanding, and then supposedly the columns, without having the lateral support of the floors, then buckled and fell apart. So that's basically their theory in summary.
That even the steel core columns buckled and fell apart?
Well, supposedly, but it doesn't make any sense, because even if you believe this idea that the perimeter columns lacking lateral support would somehow buckle and fall apart, you certainly can't apply that logic to the core structure, because the core columns were not freestanding. It was basically a lattice of steel, this very highly cross-braced structure with these huge steel columns. The dimensions of the core columns were 36 inches by outside dimensions, and they were fabricated of steel that was 4 inches thick at their base. These were very substantial structures. And so even if the floors did collapse in the way that FEMA describes, imagine they would have fallen down around the core like records on a spindle, leaving the core standing and probably leaving the perimeter column standing too. But what's even more incongruous about their theory with the actual evidence is you don't see anything that looks remotely like what they're describing when you look at these buildings come down. You don't see tall freestanding portions of columns that are buckling or anything like that. What you see is these buildings just being systematically blown up from the top to the bottom.
Right, and when you look at pictures of the building exploding outward, the dust clouds, as you've pointed out, that are beside the towers with nothing below them but air, are falling at the same speed as the buildings, right?
I think that's one of the most revealing things to point out, is that when you look at these buildings coming down, the official theory has that the top of the building is crushing the rest of the building. But that's not what's happening, obviously, because what you actually see is that there's just this cloud of dust. There's no plug at the top. There's no pile driver or anything like that that's crushing the building, because the whole top has been shredded even early in the event. Instead, what you see is that all this rubble is falling down at the same rate, whether it's falling through the air outside of the building being slowed down only by air resistance, or whether it's falling through the building and supposedly crushing the building. Now, think about that for a minute. What that means is, to believe the official story, you have to believe that falling rubble would be slowed down no more by all this intact cold steel structure, this incredibly strong structure of this building. Crushing all that structure would slow it down no more than would just falling down through the air, in both cases slowing the descent down by about 50%. It's a complete non sequitur, and it's obvious if you look at the images, particularly of the collapse of the North Tower.
So to sum up, the FEMA report explains the collapse or the explosions, as you would say, of the Twin Towers with the truss failure, meaning that the floors failed.
Yeah, the floors failed, like the connections of the floors to the columns supposedly failed, and then they just pancaked down inside the building, leaving the columns standing, and then the columns, without the lateral support supposedly of the floors, just fell apart, which is kind of like saying that the floors held up the columns rather than the columns filled up the floors. It's ludicrous.
I'm speaking with software engineer and research scientist Jim Hoffman. Today's show, Building a Better Mirage, NIST's cover-up of the crime of the century. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now there is a new official government document out, the NIST report. NIST stands for the National Institute for Standards and Technology. The NIST report is entitled The Final Report of the National Construction Safety Team on the Collapses of the World Trade Center Towers. You have written a detailed article, Building a Better Mirage, the NIST's three-year, $20 million cover-up of the crime of the century, which analyzes NIST's report and its conclusions. Jim, first of all, what is NIST, and why would NIST be chosen to do a government analysis of the collapse of the Twin Towers?
NIST, as you said, is the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and they do things like, I guess they like calibrate things and come up with standards. They would know what the exact definition of a foot is or things like that. As to why they were fingered to do this report, I don't know, probably just because they have the necessary credibility. But also, they're a non-regulatory agency. They're under the umbrella of the Department of Commerce. They're a division of the Department of Commerce. So maybe the fact that they're non-regulatory makes it safer for them to just write some report because its recommendations won't have strength of law.
I see. Now, first of all, does the NIST report agree with the FEMA report?
No, and that's very interesting because that's something that's lost on many of the people that support the official theories. And they'll point to the FEMA's report and they'll point to the NIST report as if they're have the same theory. But in some ways, the theories are kind of opposite of each other. Because recall that whereas the FEMA report blamed the failure of the truss to column connections causing this floor pancaking, NIST's report blames the persistence of these connections because the key assertion of their report is that the heating of the trusses caused the floors to sag. And as the floors sagged, the fact that these truss to column failure connections were so strong, they pulled in the columns, and that initiated this whole sequence of column instability, as they call it, and that is the key event that supposedly caused the collapse of these buildings. So they're just fundamentally opposite. They like reverse the logic of FEMA.
So just that we understand, the NIST report claims then that the connections that connected the floor trusses to the columns, to the core columns, did not fail,
Yeah. And
they pulled the columns inward.
Right. Very, very emphatically, they said, oh, there's no way they could have failed. They were way engineered beyond what they, beyond the forces that they were subjected to.
So could we then say that the FEMA report and the NIST report contradict each other?
Oh, yeah. Of course, the official line will be that, FEMA's report was just preliminary and NIST got it right. And that's why I think it's so important to really examine NIST's report because it's going to be the report that is referred to as, the final word on the collapses. It was funded with at least $20 million, so they actually had funding where FEMA didn't. So the report is just far more polished. It's a much more careful effort at hiding what really happened.
So just to review a little bit so everyone understands, what exactly is a truss? Can you describe it? And is a truss different from a connector?
Oh, yeah. Well, the word truss is used for a variety of different structures in engineering, but the word web truss refers to this thing that has the same function as a horizontal beam, like an I-beam that would support a floor or something. But instead, it's an open structure that may be about 2 feet deep and will have like a bar at the top and bottom, and then it will have bars zigzagging back and forth. So it's an open structure, but it's very efficient for carrying loads. And then it's connected to the columns via these plates and via these brackets and plates and bolts and things. So there's the truss itself, the connection. And it's interesting that most of the official collapse theories have focused on some mode of failure of the truss. Remember that FEMA blames their becoming disconnected. NIST blames their distortion and pulling in the columns. But some motive of blaming the trusses because the trusses were inside of the buildings, whereas it's obvious that the columns weren't being elevated to high temperatures they talk about, 700 degrees Celsius, because they would have been glowing red hot. You can imagine all kinds of scenarios with the trusses because you couldn't see them from outside of the building. Also, a truss is much more easily heated by a fire than the rest of the steel structure of the building because, unlike the heavy beams and columns of these buildings, the trusses have narrow pieces of steel in there and they have small points of connection to the other larger structures, and therefore they are not very good conductors of heat. And also they're up on the ceiling where the high temperatures tend to accumulate. So that's another reason that the official explanations zoom in on the trusses and try to blame them or have some kind of scenario that blames them, because it's very implausible to try to blame this total structural failure on something happening to these massive steel columns.
So then, would it be correct to say then that the trusses are sort of a light metal webbing that hold up the concrete floors?
Yeah, they were crisscross. Unlike some buildings, which only have trusses running in one direction, they were actually interlocking, so they had them running in perpendicular directions. So they created this kind of matrix of steel, this whole web of steel underneath the floors. It was about 2 feet deep and very strong. So that's basically an accurate description, that they were webs of steel.
I see. And they would be more easily heated than the steel cores because they were much thinner.
Thinner, right, and not very well connected, with small cross-sectional connections to the rest of the steel structure. So, see, one property that steel has is it's a very good conductor of heat. So if heat is applied to a large piece of steel, the heat is going to flow to the cooler parts of the steel very rapidly. And that's one of the reasons that no steel frame building has ever been totally destroyed by fires before, because steel frame buildings are very effective at wicking away the heat that's applied to one part of the building to the larger structure and dissipating the heat. There's not a single example of a steel frame high-rise building being anywhere close to totally collapsed, even any kind of major collapse event from fires, even though there's examples of very severe fires in steel frame buildings. Like there's this example of the One Meridian Plaza fire that burned in this 38-story skyscraper for 18 hours, gutting 8 floors, and yet there was apparently no significant damage to any of the columns in this building.
So then you would say that steel is a very efficient conductor of heat, so that if, let's say, we had a steel beam and one end of it got very hot, the steel beam would wick that heat away down
the
length of it?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I see. You point out in your article, Building a Better Mirage, that two terms are used quite frequently in the NIST report, collapse initiation and global collapse. What is collapse initiation as opposed to global collapse? What are they talking about?
Well, it's interesting. These two terms they're not even terms you see very much when you read engineering literature, and especially global collapse. I mean, you tend to see the term total collapse, but global collapse has this kind of mathematical ring to it. It sounds like something real. But their use of these two terms, let me describe how they fit into the construction of the report, because basically, their report has two legs. Number one is that the jet impacts and fires through this complicated series of events supposedly led to fire weakening of the steel and its column instability up to some supposed initiating event, what they call the point at which the building, this is their actual language, was poised for collapse. The second leg of their entire theory is that once there's some initial collapse event, that it then grows disproportionately to this global collapse. Now, the difference between these two legs is that where the first one is the subject of their entire report, you know, hundreds of pages, you know, how these fires supposedly spread and weaken the building and all this. The second leg, the one that collapse initiation will automatically lead to global collapse, is simply put out there as an assertion, as if that automatically happens. What's interesting about that is that it's never happened in the past. There's not a single example of some kind of local collapse event, initiating collapse event, leading to the total collapse of a steel frame building. So it's a completely unfounded presumption that global collapse will automatically follow from collapse initiation, and yet it's the core presumption of their entire report.
So most of their report, or practically all of the NIST report, addresses what they describe as collapse initiation, and that is the beginning of the buildings starting to collapse.
Wait, can I stop you there, though? It doesn't even really describe that, because they pretend that they provide, through the terms that they use in the table of contents and the construction of the report, they pretend to provide a probable collapse explanation, which is really just about this collapse initiation. But it's not even that, because what most of the report is about is detailed simulations of the crashes and the fire, and less detailed simulations of the fires and all this stuff. But even the part where they're supposedly getting to collapse initiation is extremely vague. It only occupies 1.5 pages of their multi-hundred page report. So it's as if, or it is the case, that the closer they get to the critical event, I mean, remember, the thing that was most unexpected here was the total collapse of these buildings. We understood that the planes crashed into the buildings. We understood that there were fires in the buildings. What's so unexpected is that these buildings would totally collapse. And yet, the closer we get to that event, even getting as close as talking about some kind of initiation or something, it gets extremely vague. The closer we get, the vaguer it gets. And they completely truncate the timeline before the collapse even starts. So basically, the NIST report is like this Potemkin village that pretends to explain the collapses, but it doesn't even begin to.
So the bulk of the NIST report then simply addresses the plane crashes and the subsequent fires.
Right. And it's remarkable. I have the section in the report called A Mountain of Distracting Detail, because that, I think, is the intention of the report, is to create things that are so detailed that it just gives the impression that they did this thorough job. But what most readers will miss is the disproportionate application of detail. Like, the most detailed part of the report is the simulation of the plane crashes. They use these finite element models to model the planes, the engines, the buildings, and the crashes with phenomenal detail. They modeled the plane engines down to the turbine blade. They have every seat in the airplane modeled. They have every strut in the wing modeled. It's just remarkable, and they produce a very realistic simulation of the impact damage of Flight 11 into the North Tower. Well, if only they would apply some of their millions of dollars to trying to model why these buildings exploded when they came down, I think it would be a much more appropriate use of public resources.
How is the NIST report doing all of this modeling? Is this on computers?
Yeah, they have a number of computer models. It's actually kind of hard to even decipher what all their computer models are. Another aspect of their trying to lose the forest for the trees by inserting so much irrelevant detail. So they have various models. One, they have a global model of the building, which is a very crude model, which they say they use to validate some of their other models. They have a model of the airplane that I described and so forth. They also have, perhaps the most important model is what they call the global floor model, which is not global because it only includes the portion of the building about 10 floors around each of the crash zones. So they don't even model the whole building. That's the part that supposedly models the actual collapses, and it doesn't even model, only models a small portion of the building. And what I find very interesting about that, they provide images of this global floor model in their report, and they provide this theory of how the building started to collapse, part of it started to tip, and they have this whole vague but explanation of how this event started. And yet, they don't show any images in the report of the global model showing this behavior. So it's not clear from their report. In fact, the report suggests to me that their model didn't even begin to show the behavior that they said happened, that is leading up to the initiation of collapse. I don't think their models even, they could even get their models to exhibit that behavior.
So then are you saying that the narrative in the report doesn't really match the illustrations?
Oh, yeah, and in a lot of ways. I mean, there's a lot of internal contradictions in the report. They talk about core temperatures, extremely high core temperatures, that is fires in the core structures of these buildings. And then there's illustrations in their report that has pseudocolor showing the intensity of the fire on various floors, and they show that the cores are relatively cool. So, you know, it's just one example of numerous places in which the report doesn't justify their conclusions. And it takes a lot of work to discover all these things. You have to read through the whole report, like their description of the temperatures in the core is separated by maybe 40 pages from this illustration that shows that that's clearly not the case according to their own models.
I'm speaking with software engineer and research scientist Jim Hoffman. Today's show, Building a Better Mirage, NIST's cover-up of the crime of the century. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You say that NIST's theory about the effects of crash and fire damage is flawed. How so?
That's fairly complicated because they do a great job with the crash. I think they do a marvelous job of modeling the crash. When you get into their fire modeling, it becomes very implausible for a number of reasons. Well, first of all, they use a lot of techniques that are basically propaganda. I have the section that I call cinematic emphasis, where they repeatedly say how steel will become weakened by fires, making it sound as if steel, if there's any fire exposure of steel, will just immediately collapse. They say things like bare structural steel components, when exposed to large and Sustained fire heat can heat rapidly to the point where the ability to support load is compromised. Bare steel components can heat quickly when exposed to a fire of even moderate intensity. So they just kind of keep, you know, pounding that message in. But if you think about it, you know, think about examples of steel exposed to fire, like a fireplace grating. Those don't just, you know, collapse instantly when they even when they become red hot, or like a, you know, wood stove. Wood stove is made out of steel and has a pretty hot fire inside, and it's optimized to elevate the temperature into, you know, for a hot fire, unlike a building fire. And you don't see, you know, wood stoves suddenly falling apart or exploding or anything like that. So they use all these kind of propagandistic techniques, you know, using phrases like the forces would eventually overwhelm the already damaged building. No quantitative detail at all, just repeating these kind of phrases. But the part I find most telling is how they calibrate their models. And some of the things are pretty amazing, because they make a lot of points about how they calibrate their models, or they use experiments to justify what's in their models. Well, let's look at what one of those experiments was. Here's an excerpt from a report. A spray burner generating 1.9 megawatts or 3.4 megawatts of power was ignited in a 23-foot by 11.8-foot by 12-foot compartment. The temperatures near the ceiling approached 900 degrees Celsius. Now think about that. A megawatt, 1.9 to 3.4 megawatts. A megawatt is 1,000 kilowatts. A typical wood stove, when it's fully cranked, maybe puts out 7 kilowatts. So we're talking about the power of about 500 wood stoves in a chamber that's about the size of a living room. I mean, that's just outrageous. And that's what they're using to justify that they're modeling 900 degree ceiling temperatures. Then they calibrate it with the supposed workstation test of burning workstations, and they say that they rubblized workstations and set them on fire in this compartment, and they say the jet fuel greatly accelerated the fire growth. They say that they achieved 800 to 1100 degrees Celsius near ceiling temperatures. Now, they don't disclose how much jet fuel they poured on the rubblized workstations to achieve those temperatures, but you know, considering that they had to use that 3-megawatt super burner to achieve 900 degree ceiling temperatures, I would imagine they used a lot of jet fuel. And this is just an example of how they support their models with these experiments, but the experiments have nothing to do with real world, and they don't disclose how much jet fuel they put on those workstations or anything like that. It's just this black box. You can't see what's behind their models. They don't publish their models. They don't publish the data for their models. You can't download them. It's like you can't see how they assembled their report.
Isn't it true that there's evidence that the fires in the Twin Towers were going out?
Well, not in both Twin Towers. There are two very different cases, which is often ignored. The North Tower actually had fires that over time expanded upward and extended into across the floors, and there were entire floors where you can see there was extensive fires you could see outside of the building, at least near the perimeter where you could actually see them. And after the South Tower collapsed, the fires in the North Tower looked about the most intense of the entire event. So that's one case. But the South Tower, the one that was hit by the kind of glancing blow where the plane, where most a lot of the fuselage popped out the other side of the building and where most of the fuel burned up in the atmosphere, those fires, if you comb over the photographs and videos, you can't see any visible flames at the time the South Tower collapsed. The flames dwindled over time, and the smoke became blacker. Now, 11 minutes before the collapse of the South Tower, we have a radio call from Chief Oriole Palmer, who described the fires on the 78th floor, which is right near the crash zone where he had reached, as two small pockets of fire that could be put out with two lines. So how interesting then that the South Tower was the first to go just as the fires appeared to be going out. The NIST report doesn't mention Chief Oriole's radio call. Instead, it makes it sound like it was impossible for the firefighters to even reach the crash zones, or they couldn't possibly have done anything. They said it would take hours to accumulate sufficient people and equipment to access the impact zones. But here, Chief Oriole Palmer had already gotten to the impact zone, so it's just totally misrepresents what was going on. Moreover, it's very interesting that the NIST report, which has tremendous detail about certain things, observational detail about the extents of the fires in the buildings, and they mix that with pure speculation about other things, about the intensity of the fires in the cores, and don't disclose the fact that they're mixing pure speculation with great detail. But anyway, they do provide a detailed visual summary of the extents of the fires in the North Tower, and they show two different snapshots in time showing that the fires in the North Tower had actually progressed and had gotten more extensive. But they only show one snapshot of the South Tower. Why? Because if they showed a second snapshot of the South Tower, it would be obvious that the fires were dying down. and nowhere do they hint that that was the case.
And, of course, as you've mentioned, the South Tower, with the fires obviously going out, collapsed before the North Tower, and it was the North Tower that was hit by a plane initially.
The time between the crash and the collapse of the North Tower was 102 minutes, contrasting with only 56 minutes for the South Tower. And again, remember, the South Tower had less severe crash damage. So NIST's entire detailed analysis and timeline stops at the moment the building is, quote, poised for collapse. So they stop their entire investigation, their analysis, their timelines, their modeling before the event even begins, before the core event even begins. And the thing I like to emphasize is that, so they're given $20 million of our public money to study this event. And yes, the plane crashes are important. Yes, the fires are important. But consider, if you break it down, you have three deadly events. You have the plane crashes that killed people. It was a horrible event. You had the fires that killed more people, especially the people that were trapped in the North Tower. And then you had the total collapses, which killed at least as many people and were by far the most traumatic and destructive events of all. And by far the least expected and the only events of all three that violated all engineering expectations, all history. The history of steel frame buildings that I pointed out, there's never been a case of a total collapse of a steel frame high-rise building induced by fire. That should have been the main question. How could you have the total collapse of these buildings from those causes? And yet the proportional allocation of their investigation is exactly inverted with respect to those priorities. They have the most detail about the plane crashes, less detail about the fires, and as you get closer and closer to the supposed initiation of collapse, it just falls right off, and they explicitly truncate their timeline at the initiation of collapse. They say, quote, "The focus of the investigation was the sequence of events from the instant of aircraft impact to the initiation of collapse of each tower. For brevity of this report, this sequence is referred to as, quote, the probable collapse sequence, although it does not actually include the structural behavior of the tower after the conditions for collapse initiation were reached and collapse became inevitable." Here they're amplifying this totally unsupported point that global collapse is inevitable once collapse initiation occurs. There's no basis for that whatsoever, and yet it's there as just a blatant assertion in their report. Now, why do they truncate their investigation at the point of collapse, apart from that the fact that they can't explain the total collapses of the building because it's completely unscientific to suppose that any collapse event would lead to global collapse, given that there's no precedent and you probably can't even demonstrate the alleged phenomenon? More importantly, by truncating the timeline before the collapse even begins, they don't have to talk about what the collapses actually looked like, because the collapses exhibited all the features of a controlled demolition. But these features don't become evident until after the collapse begins. What are those features? The buildings came straight down into their footprints, or blew out, but they maintain radial symmetry around the vertical axis as the destruction proceeded to the ground. That's like all controlled demolitions. Controlled demolitions are designed to bring a building straight down so it doesn't topple. They came down with very rapid speed. They came down as if there was nothing more than air slowing the descent of all the rubble. They have these what I call demolition waves, which are concurrent explosions that proceed down the building. There are these things, demolition squibs, these high-velocity gas ejections. The pulverization of these buildings and the totality of the collapses are all features that are observed in controlled demolition, only in most controlled demolitions, just not nearly to the degree. Because in most controlled demolitions, the building is brought straight down. It happens very quickly, rapid onset. There is a lot of dust, and the steel skeleton is broken up. But it's not shredded in the way that the Twin Towers were. You don't have the degree of pulverization. They don't blanket a city with fine dust from the thorough pulverization of the 90,000 tons of concrete in each building. So these features are beyond what's in a normal controlled demolition. And paradoxically, the fact that the destruction is so much greater, I think, makes it more difficult for people to understand that these were controlled demolitions, because it was so far outside of their experience. But if you think about it logically, the greater degree of destruction of these buildings is all the more evidence of explosives and controlled demolitions, because you need to put even more destructive energy to achieve this more thorough degree of destruction. But to return, none of these features are even considered by NIST. None of them are admitted, because their entire investigation stops before the event even begins.
That's right. You say in your article, Building a Better Mirage, that by truncating its investigation at collapse initiation, NIST avoids having to consider and disclose the subsequent evidence of controlled demolition, which is what you've just described.
Yeah, and think about it. All these features that I describe, all this, you know, the pulverization, the squibs, the rapidity, the verticality, these are all features that have never been observed in any kind of natural destruction of a steel frame building. And there's lots of examples of collapses, of extensive collapses of steel frame buildings, like, say, in earthquakes. Look at the photographs of, say, the Taiwan earthquake. You have all these buildings that are toppled over, but they're not crushed. They're not shredded or anything like you see at Ground Zero. I mean, Ground Zero, in the wake of this event, looked like it was a smoking crater. It smoked for months. The buildings were thoroughly shredded. You couldn't even tell where these buildings stood except for those little shards of the remaining perimeter walls. If you look at Ground Zero, it's just everywhere.
What's a squib? You mentioned a squib.
So a squib is kind of a slang term in demolition for a high-velocity gas ejection. It's like a sudden jet that emerges from the building. There's about three very distinct sets of squibs that occur at different elevations in the North Tower, and they're well below the zone of total destruction. They're just these very energetic jets shooting out at about 100, 200 feet a second from the facade in a very symmetric way on the different faces. So they're in both faces that you can see of the building, and they proceed down. And these are observed in normal controlled demolitions, but usually not so energetically. Now, the official explanation for these, to the extent that anybody addresses them, which, like I said, NIST doesn't even get anywhere close to looking at these features, is that the collapsing floors were pushing out air. That doesn't make any sense because these aren't air. These are like pulverized materials being ejected. And if the floors were collapsing, the concrete couldn't be getting broken up until they already impact. But by that time, the air would have already been squeezed out. Moreover, if you look at the photographs, you can see that these mushrooming clouds of pulverized concrete are above the zone of where the squibs is. So if these squibs are from the pancaking floors, supposedly inside the building, which there's no evidence of, then where's all this pulverized material above coming from? Because the floors are supposedly pancaking down. Moreover, if the floors really did pancake, where's the stack of floor diaphragms at the bottom afterwards? You can't even find any evidence of any macroscopic chunks of concrete or anything like that if looking at photographs of Ground Zero, because the floor diaphragms didn't pancake. They were shredded. They were just exploded like every other part of the building.
And these squibs that you're describing, they are clearly visible in the videos.
Oh, yeah. Some show them better than others, but they're clearly visible, and they're in numerous videos, too, and you can cross-correlate them. Like, you can look at different videos and see the same squibs. One of the fortunate things is, despite the fact that they destroyed all the steel as fast as they could, there are hundreds of photographs and videos, and some with pretty good resolution. And these can be cross-compared. So you can take the videos of the collapses and then look at the evolution of features in those and then actually get the time coordinates of different photographs relative to the videos and corroborate different features. So there's no editing or anything going on here. This is abundant physical evidence that it's this very large body of photographs and videos from which quantitative measurements can be made. It's hard physical evidence, and it proves that these buildings were destroyed by controlled demolition.
And I've noticed that the squibs are clearly visible below the portions of the buildings that are actually exploding or collapsing.
Yeah. So as I was pointing out, that being the case, then if those were the floors, then there wouldn't be any way of explaining all this dust and all this pulverized concrete up above, because the only concrete constituents of these buildings were the 4-inch thick floor slabs.
I'm speaking with software engineer and research scientist Jim Hoffman. Today's show, Building a Better Mirage, NIST's cover-up of the crime of the century. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What do you say to the claim that people make that the Twin Towers were shoddily constructed? Or another claim I've heard people make is that the Twin Towers were designed to pancake.
Okay, the first one. It's refuted by just the fact that these buildings stood for as many years as they did without any sign that there was any problem. The forces that a skyscraper is subjected to in its normal life are just huge. They act like sails, and the winds higher up, like even at 1,000 feet, are a lot greater than on the surface. So these buildings, just during their lifetime, had to experience over 100-mile-an-hour winds. They're designed to withstand, you know, probably 140-mile or even faster winds, because those can happen. They're designed to, like, withstand the worst incident that could be expected in the lifetime of the buildings, and these buildings are designed to last, you know, a long time. And earthquakes, you know, earthquakes can be, probably magnitude 7 earthquakes are possible in that area, and those are like the most severe forces probably that these buildings could encounter. Earthquakes and hurricanes are way beyond the kind of stresses that the mere gravity loads like above the crash zones in these towers produced. So the idea these buildings could just crumble, and yet they were strong enough to stand up all these years, that you can't reconcile those two. And also, that kind of explanation ignores over-design ratios, which are just a normal thing in engineering. So any large engineering structure like a bridge or a big steel building will be designed with a considerable amount of excess capacity just as a margin of safety, because you don't know what kind of unpredictable events, maybe combinations of events could occur that could subject these to great stresses. So normal over-design ratios are maybe 3-to-1 or 5-to-1, probably more like 10 or 20-to-1, at least according to Kevin Ryan in the case of the Twin Towers. The over-design ratios of the exterior walls were about 20-to-1. So that means that, you know, even if the worst thing happened that would be expected in the lifetime of the building is engineered with so much excess capacity that it could withstand 10 or 20 times that much force and still not just crumble.
What about the claim that they were designed to pancake?
First of all, it's just completely invalidated by just looking at the structure of these buildings. They had these massive core structures. Now, I already played out the scenario of the floors pancaking, and even if that could have happened, it would have left the core structure standing and perhaps the outer wall standing as well.
If skyscrapers were designed to pancake, then why would they need to have controlled demolition on them, number one? And number two, what strikes me as so funny is that if skyscrapers were designed to pancake, then they would smash all the people in the building, right?
Well, if they were designed to pancake, one might be concerned that that behavior might start unexpectedly for some other reason. The idea is ridiculous. Controlled demolition companies get millions of dollars to bring buildings down into their footprints. That's completely against the natural tendency of any large steel structure like that, because it's a basic principle of physics that natural processes follow the path of least resistance, not the path of maximum resistance. So the fact that these buildings came straight down through themselves violates the most basic intuition about how physical processes work. Because everybody has experience of things toppling. I mean, if you were to, you know, take a radio tower or something, it would just fall straight down through itself. It would topple over. And especially if you look at the South Tower did start to topple, or apparently started to topple at first, and then it stopped toppling and just started to explode. That's completely contrary to what should have happened in a natural process, because when something starts to topple, it doesn't just stop toppling and then start to crush itself. It topples faster and faster because you have a torque that's being applied at the fulcrum, and gravity is making it fall faster and faster. It's accelerating and picking up angular momentum. And so the fact that the top of the South Tower stopped rotating is one of many proofs that these buildings were demolished, because there's no way to explain it, the fact that it stopped toppling, except through the observation that the entire building was destroyed, and so that the moment of inertia was destroyed and there was no more fulcrum.
I even had someone say to me, well, the buildings had to be designed to pancake, because otherwise, if they fell over, they would endanger the other buildings surrounding them.
Well, how often do buildings fall over? I mean, we have no examples of skyscrapers just falling over, except in earthquakes, and those aren't really skyscrapers. Those are more like, you know, 20, 30-story buildings, the cases that we've seen. There were thousands of high-rises that were destroyed in the Taiwan earthquake, and none of those fell straight down. They all fell over. That's the way, it's the basic way that a structure, especially a steel structure, behaves, because, you know, steel is resilient. It's not going to just crush itself from top to bottom. The whole basis of the official story is that these buildings experienced what's called top-down progressive collapse. It's a scientific-sounding term. It's another name for the pancaking theory. But if you think about it, consider the fact that there is no example that I can find, or that anybody that I know has been able to find, of any structure experiencing top-down total progressive collapse. Now, the scientific method says that in order for a phenomenon to be real, to take it seriously, you have to be able to reproduce it. If this phenomenon is not reproducible, if top-down total progressive collapse is not reproducible, then, you know, logic says that the phenomenon doesn't exist. It's not scientific to say the phenomenon exists, because it can't be reproduced.
In your article, Building a Better Mirage, NIST's 3-year, $20 million cover-up of the crime of the century, where you deconstruct the official NIST report, the second government report, you have a section called Fudging the Models, and you also talk about the alteration of Flight 175's path in their modeling. What about all of that?
Well, it's very interesting that even though NIST's report doesn't even begin to explain the collapses or even provide a plausible explanation of collapse initiation, they still, for some reason, felt compelled, apparently, to tweak their models and to alter what was apparently good data in order to make their models produce the results they wanted. For one thing, they created a set of four scenarios for the plane crashes that had different parameters. So two scenarios for each tower, scenario A through D. They had a first set of scenarios which were, I guess, based on what looked accurate. And then they didn't get the behavior they wanted, supposedly, so they went and altered the parameters to make a second scenario in which they increased the speed of the plane by a few percent, decreased the approach angles, increased the aircraft weight by about 5%, its strength by about 25 or 15%, decreased the tower strength by about 20%, decreased the tower's live load, increased the fuel load in the towers by 25%. All those seem to be relatively small changes, but taken in the aggregate, they create a completely different scenario. And then supposedly when they run their models with those, they get the better results. So, okay, how interesting. Perhaps a more egregious example is the lengths to which they had to go to explain the fact that the South Tower fell first. I think that was one of their major challenges because it's such an obvious thing to people. If they see that the most of the jet fuel burned up in the fireball, the plane, you know, part of the plane popped out the other side, the damage wasn't as severe, and the fires seemed to be going out, how could the South Tower fall first? So they went to considerable lengths to adjust their models, apparently, to account for how the South Tower fell first. Now, they describe this in detail, these illustrations that show the number of four columns that were severed by each of the flights. And they actually indicate there's maybe eight columns in the South Tower that are supposedly totally severed. But how can they justify that when almost all the plane completely missed the core of the South Tower? Well, for one thing, they don't disclose the fact that part of the plane popped out the other side. They don't disclose the fact, apparently, that most of the fuel was burned up outside of the building. They hide those facts that speak to the mitigation of the damage. But more importantly, they claim that there was actually more core damage in the South Tower than in the North Tower. Now, think of it. The planes of about the same size, one crashes into the North Tower at the 95th floor, another crashes into the South Tower twice as far down the building. The steel in these buildings is tapered in a way that's proportional to how far down the building you are. So the steel at the 80th floor level was about twice as thick as the steel at the 95th floor. And so not only does the plane miss the core in the South Tower and plow into it in the North Tower, but also the steel is twice as thick at the level of the South Tower, and yet they're claiming that the South Tower had more core damage. Completely unjustified conclusion. And that's just the example to the contortions they go to cover up the fact that really the smoking gun that the South Tower fell first. Another distortion that they make is to shrink the core columns. I think it's interesting that they actually have images of their global floor model, this thing that shows about 10 floors of each tower. And if you look at the core columns in these models, they're like little toothpicks, even smaller than the perimeter columns. So they're in the long tradition of the other reports and the 9/11 Commission report itself in the thing I call core denial, because the 9/11 Commission report made the following statement about these buildings. They said, the interior core of the Twin Towers was a hollow steel shaft in which the elevators and stairwells were grouped, totally ignoring the matrix of 47 steel box columns, these huge box columns in the core, just a blatant lie. Of course, NIST doesn't deny the existence of the core columns. They just apparently minimize their dimensions in order to make their model more likely to produce the result that they want.
So then would you say that the major flaw in the NIST report, although obviously in your opinion and according to your article, Building a Better Mirage, that there are many flaws in the NIST report, but the main flaw is that the bulk of the 300-page report is addressed to the plane crashes, the fires, and right up to the point where the buildings begin to collapse, and then there isn't much of any further evidence in the report.
There's no further evidence in the report, although there is actually one collapse image in the report, which is probably there to be able to deny that charge, but they don't even comment on it. So, no, there's basically nothing in the report beyond this, quote, initiation of collapse, or when the building is poised for collapse, nothing. And that's the biggest omission. So it's important not to get bogged down in all the tricks that they play and all the deceptions that about the fires and the severity of the fires and all that, because the critical thing is the fact that they just completely avoid the core issue of how these buildings really collapsed and what the collapses actually looked like.
So the collapses of the Twin Towers and how that actually happened is not really addressed much at all in this report.
No, I mean, because they say explicitly that they don't consider anything past the initiation of collapse. So They don't even mention any of these demolition-like features. They don't even attempt to explain why the buildings came straight down, why there was so much dust production, how they pulverized themselves, how the apparently vaporized 1,000 people because no trace of their bodies was ever even found. You know, just all these things, and they just don't even begin to address them. In very much the same way as the 9/11 Commission report, it's the same modus operandi, which is to create this very complex scenario with all this detail, you know, in this case about the fires and everything, in the case of the 9/11 Commission report about the hijackers and all the what they were doing beforehand. And it just acts as a big diversion away from what really happened, all the huge red flags of, in the case of the total collapses of these buildings, how they could have totally collapsed when it's completely outside of any example that you can point to. There's no example of top-down progressive collapse, let alone one that shows all the standard, all the features of a controlled demolition.
Wasn't an author for a building trade publication working on an article that contrasted your analysis of the NIST report with people who support the conclusions of the NIST report?
The NIST report looks so prodigious. It looks so intimidating until you really figure out what it is and how it completely avoids the issue that it's nothing but a Potemkin village. What's so interesting is that it can't stand up to the light of day. I mean, it looks great if you just look at it by itself, but I think, you know, to the extent that this article, Building a Better Mirage, becomes more public, it's just obvious what a fraud the report is. And I think another example of that, of just how it can't stand up to the light of day, is this incident that happened with Walls and Ceilings magazine, an article that was going to come out in it, because one of the authors that worked for this magazine had interviewed me and was interviewing a number of people that were defending the NIST report, a number of experts, and created this beautifully crafted article that had us debating the two sides. It would have a quote from me and have a quote from some expert, and it was this back and forth. And I later found out from the author that the editors had decided to spike the article or were insisting that they pull all of my quotes from the article, so it would be a completely one-sided article. Then a few days later, I heard that the author was fired. So the article apparently will not appear at all. But I think that this speaks to the fact that this theory of NIST can't survive examination. It's just a completely one-sided thing, and its success depends entirely on its being uncritically accepted and presented as a strictly one-sided argument.
Jim Hoffman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
I've been speaking with Jim Hoffman. You've been listening to Building a Better Mirage, NIST's cover-up of the crime of the century. Jim Hoffman has been researching the World Trade Center collapses since February 2003 and has created an extensive website reporting his investigations and other aspects of the September 11th attacks. He can be contacted by email at jim@wtc7.net. Visit his website at www.wtc7.net. That's www.wtc7.net. Or Google 9/11 Research. Sound on today's show was recorded by Kelly Ramirez. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Yara Mako and me, Bonnie Faulkner. To leave comments or order copies of our shows, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. A memorial for Ted Friedman, longtime KPFA supporter and listener representative on the KPFA local station board, is this Sunday, January 8th at 4 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist at Cedar and Bonita in Berkeley. I hope those of you who knew and loved Ted will be able to attend. Also this Saturday, January 7th at 3 p.m., the Social Justice Center of Marin will host a discussion on the practicality of impeachment in San Anselmo at 1000 Sir Francis Drake Boulevard, Room 18. More information at 415-388-2821. Next week, I have some exciting new programming for you with Michel Chosadovsky on America's War on Terrorism. So I hope to see you next week.
This is your listener-sponsored radio station, 94.1 FM, KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and also online.